Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. This is Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One. Thank you very much for joining us today for another edition of Midrats. And hey, lucky you. This is one of our world-famous, ever-popular, all-desirable melee format. We don't have any guests today. It's just the two of us and you. That means that we have our list of things we want to talk about, but we always like to open up the conversation more than even usual to our listeners who make the extra effort to join us live. So we do have the chat room up and running this week. We see Paul, as always, standing at parade rest, ready to greet everybody there. Paul is, if you always know that Paul, that something's not right in the world if Paul isn't there. It's the chat room or the moons are aligned or something like that. So it's great to see Paul there, bright, shiny, and early. If you have some questions or topics you would like to address to either one of us during the course of the show, that is a great way to do it. Also, if you follow me on X or Twitter, whatever you want to call it, if you want to send me a DM or at me or anything like that, I always keep that open during the show because always have a couple of comments roll our way. And of course, if you're with us live, that means you are staring at the show page with the chat room at the bottom. And at the upper right-hand corner, you have the studio line. So if you want to call in on the studio line, and I know like yesterday, our good friend Jerry, he was listening to us live as he was driving from one part of the free state of Florida to the other. You can call the guest phone-in number. It's area code 347-308-8397, 347-308-8397. But besides that, welcome, co-host. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Sal. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing my best not to monologue. So, you know, everything's about self-help and self-improvement. But I think I'll pick off where we ended up about 45 seconds ago. For the listeners, during the pre-show, we have this really complicated and intricate method of finding out what we're going to talk about during the show. Not really, but we like to go through with what we think has broken above the ambient noise, at least for us, to talk about. And one thing that was on both of our lists that I think is going to cover quite a few topics, and it is top of the news. We could all give a nice little golf clap to the Houthis. They finally sunk their first ship. It took a while. And I'm a simple man with simple thoughts. And because I grew up in a coastal area with a pirate history, when I saw a drifting ship with, I don't know what, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of tons of ammonium nitrate fertilizer is worth nowadays. She was down by the stern. She had one anchor floating around. I think Sal McCaugliano on his What's Up with Shipping podcast can really give people some details on it. She bounced around, scraped some cables here and there, but she did finally sink. And one thing that popped into mind. One, what are the salvage rights of anybody who wanted to go up there? Why was no salvage attempt ever done? Why wasn't there even a tug available in an area like the Red Sea? And is that something or a capability that when the Houthis started popping things off at people, the Imperial we with our, what is it, Prosperity Guardian, one of our allies, who didn't quite have the desire or capability to, you know, put a warship on the line, could have sent salvage and recovery teams to help out should a merchant ship get hit. So those are the big three things I was thinking about was salvage, possible recovery, and why was she just allowed to go there? And now she's between her fuel oil and that fertilizer. For those that haven't been scuba diving or snorkeling in the Red Sea, it's one of those beautiful places in the world underwater. Now they're going to have that off their coast.
Yeah, it's just one more exciting thing that the Houthis have managed to do. And I think your question about salvage, I mean, anybody can try and salvage a ship that's been abandoned by its crew. But the question is, who wants to go after a ship that's dead in the water and containing fertilizer, which as I, you know, can, which can be pretty dangerous if mixed with other things. And I guess nobody did. So, and you get into this also, these issues of we've talked about this before, the flags of convenience. It's a Belize flagship, British registered, Lebanese operated. You know, so who really owns this thing? Who has any interest in getting a tug out there, to ocean-going tug out there to try and retrieve it? Could it be retrieved? Where could you take it? It's leaking oil. You know, not too many places want that kind of vessel dragged into their port.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just one of those situations that I guess, you know, everybody decided just to leave it alone.
And a merchant ship, unlike a warship, it doesn't have that many watertight compartments that can help stop it from sinking. But she wasn't sinking fast. She was floating around for, I think, a week and a half. Give me plus or minus a week here, maybe a little bit more. But you're right. You know, who, if everybody owns something, nobody owns anything. And I don't care whether you're the Port of Los Angeles or Port Sudan. If you have a bunch of guys with, 18 warrants in 42 nations saying, hey, I've got this half-sunk merchant ship. I want to bring up your channel. Can you give me some pier space? Or, you know, that's not going to happen.
And the good news is it's leaking oil and it's full of fertilizer. So, yeah, I mean, who wouldn't want that? I mean, I remember years ago, but back in the early 50s or late 40s, a ship loaded with fertilizer blew up in the port of Houston, and it kind of scarred the industry for quite a while about the safety of some of these things.
As they say in that wonderful part of the world, for you, my friend, special, special price. Not same thing. Very good ammonium nitrate. Very good. Yeah, that would not go well in the souk, I don't think. But that... I really wonder, you know, if that, of all the international agreements and all the meetings that people come to and all the gnashing of teeth and rending of clothes that people talk about things that you can argue whether humans have much of an effect in, I'm talking about global climate change. There are things you can see, you can measure, and this has been one of my hobby horses for a long time, is we can measure, we can control, and we do know it's human-sourced, is pollution. We can, whether you're talking about the nightmarish plastic issues that we have in the Pacific and in parts of the Caribbean, or whether you have talking about boats full of toxic, non-natural fertilizer, though, you know, that much guano wouldn't be too great for the environment either. And I assume that that ship was probably... that will don't have plans to do things, even if that plan is getting up of the Red Sea, get into the Indian Ocean. So she's got to sink, let her sink in waters, deep waters off Somalia that have good circulation that can move the garbage around, as opposed to a relatively closed water like the Red Sea. Maybe it'll sink to the bottom and just some fertilizer, it will solidify in water. However, I don't think that's really what you're going to see here. For instance, you know, when I'm planting my food plots, my fertilizer, it melts, which is what it's supposed to do. So odds are that's what's going to happen, and anything nearby will take hit. So I guess we're waiting for the next ship to get hit. However, I don't know. Have you noticed the last week? I just haven't. Maybe it's because the rest isn't reporting it because it's not news anymore. But besides the German Navy shooting at everything that moves, including a U.S. UAV, it appears that the Houthis have slowed down a bit, at least on their volume of strikes. Maybe that's indicative of the fact that their supply might be a little limited.
Yeah, that could be. Or every time, you know, if maybe with any luck, every time they pop up, somebody's shooting at them or dropping bombs on them or whatever we're doing with the aircraft from the carrier we have down there. I forgot to mention the other thing about this ship was it was chartered by the Saudis. So, you know, it gets more complicated. You know, it's not just none of these things with shipping are ever easy, which is why Sal Carcliano is such a great asset to people who are following him on X and his YouTube channel. So it's good stuff.
Yeah, I'm really happy for him that it's taken off as well as it has had. I remember the first time we had him on here as a guest, you and I were both like, man, he's good. So it's and he really has filled a niche that in that unsexy but important sector of the maritime arena that was not being served. You know, G Captain and John Conrad, you know, does a lot of the heavy lifting in that area, but it's mostly written. And I know he's done John Conrad has done a couple of spaces on X, which have been informative and good, partially because he let me talk on one of them. Ha-ha. But if you had said 5 or 6 years ago, hey, you're going to have a professor who knows stuff about the merchant marine and shipping issues, he's going to go up on YouTube, and that's what he's going to talk about, and he's going to have well north of 100,000 subscribers to his channel, people would have tilted their head at you a bit, but he does. And a lot of it is because of his personality and his knowledge and his presentation, but a lot of it is the fact he's just giving out good, reliable information that you cannot find anywhere else. I think there's a lesson there because there are some other underserved areas. I think you just need to find that area's Sal Marcogliano to fill in that information space. It's really become valuable. And I know that a couple of significant decision makers have tapped into the service that Sal has been able to provide in that area to everybody's benefit. It's really a great thing to see.
Yeah, I think that, you know, those of us who applied in the waters of shipping and as a maritime attorney, I did occasionally do that. You know, it is a much more complex and fascinating world than many people realize, but it is challenged by the fact that we have allowed all these flags of convenience and things. So nobody, you know, sometimes nobody's really responsible for whatever is happening. So it's just one of those. And this is one of those instances. I mean, the Saudis don't want to send a tug out because they're one of the reasons the Houthis are fighting everybody. So I would guess that it's going to sink. It's going to sit there. You know, maybe that stuff is soluble. I think Paul is trying to tell me that it's soluble, but he was talking about ammonium nitrate. We'll have to look up ammonium phosphate, and we'll see how that works out. If it's soluble, just dissipates in the water and becomes whatever its elements are, that'd be great. But we'll have to find out. Now, the oil, that's a whole different thing. And it's just going to pollute for a while.
Yeah, well, one thing about bunker fuel is right on the edge of living memory, we filled the Atlantic floor full of merchant ships with bunker fuel and during World War II that we sunk, well, we as humans, mostly the Germans. And I remember as a little kid, we still find them now and then when we go to the beach. But when I was a little kid back in the early 70s, still find those oily balls all over the place on the beach after certain storms in certain directions. Don't see them as much now. So yeah, there's I think the ability for the oceans to absorb one more ship at the bottom is probably going to be okay, unless if it's shallow enough and gets localized and get on those absolutely beautiful reefs if they were off the coast of California, they would be a national treasure.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, all of us who've ever trod the beaches of Galveston know that tar balls are an issue, and they're issue on the California coast too, actually. So, and it's natural, you know, some of it's just natural seepage. I don't know about the Red Sea. It looks like from the pictures I've seen that the water's remarkably clear. I know people who've been scuba diving in the northern part of the Red Sea really have enjoyed their trips. I've never heard anybody. Know anybody who's gone diving down there in the Barbara Mandel Strait? So,
no, not in a long time. They don't quite have the, how can we say this politely? They don't have beach culture there, so it's not a big thing. But I know especially after Desert Storm, you could pull into port in Saudi Arabia. And you could, it was an amazing time. You're obviously an American. You could walk around town. You could do anything you wanted to do. You could hire somebody and you could go scuba diving if you were qualified, or snorkeling if not, in the area. What is it on the Red Sea coast? Right west of Mecca, whatever that place is called. Anyway, It's beautiful there, but that's for them to worry about. One thing we also talked about in the pre-show that might be fun to talk about, mostly because we can thank and laugh at the Germans at the same time. But there was news that broke last week about one of the German frigates that has participated. They just went warning red, weapons free. In addition to shooting, it appeared from what I read in the report, a couple of attack drones. They also took a shot at one of our predators or reapers that was up at 30,000 feet or so. I guess that that's something that the U.S. Navy has a little more experience in than the Germans. But you can't fault them if you're – that was not one of their newest frigates with their best radar system. And I guess you have to be a little bit humble when, you know, we had the Vincennes down an airliner thinking it was a ship. But anti-air warfare, it's not easy, which, you know, goes back to what we talked about in our previous show. You've got to, you know, tip the hat to the U.S. Surface Force. The schoolhouse they've been giving everybody else, and I'm sure they're going to be sharing the lessons with our allies about how to conduct anti-air warfare against slow-moving drones, anti-ship cruise missiles, and the new kid on the block, the anti-ship ballistic missiles, is just impressive. I think one of the things that's going to come out of this is you really need something comparable to the latest builds of Aegis to really do it right. I don't think that German ship was quite at that level to be able to give the skipper the confidence he needed. And, you know, you can't blame him. If it looks bad, it is bad.
Yeah, it's everybody makes mistakes, and I guess they didn't really do any harm to our equipment, and they actually downed a couple of or several of the Houthi things. So that's good. I mean, this whole Houthi, you know, the Houthis are now claiming, we've got this latest thing, the unmanned guided undersea weapon. I'm thinking everybody else is going, is that a torpedo?
Yeah. Torpedo with a snorkel from the looks of it.
Yeah. So, you know, they've learned some lessons from the Ukrainians. And they also, you know, one of their leaders went on, I don't know, he was quoted in the Hindu Times or something, saying that they're going to have some surprises for the West coming up. And, you know, you never know. But one of the things that did happen, though, is it's either that sunken ship, which dragged anchor across some of the international cables that carry internet and telephone lines and all that other stuff, and caused a disruption. And I know you just had a piece on that in your Substack area. Talk a little bit about that, because that's a pretty major area of concern.
It is, and I think it's one of those things that if you are a sub-fourth rate power at sea, like the Houthi, and I don't mean to insult them. I mean they took the best the Saudis and the Emiratis could throw at them, and they're still standing. We've spanked them a few times, and they're still standing. They're like, you know, give me your best. I've got plenty of cot to chew on, so let's go at it. And the Iranians will keep supplying them, but a lot of these cables were laid for commercial reasons. They're not worried about security. They're worried about cost per nautical mile to lay your cable. And they're just laying there on the floor. They're not defended. And you can't defend something that, you know, little circles the planet like that. And you don't need anything fancy or even that complicated when you, you know, pipelines are different than cables, but they're both on the bottom. It looks like, quote, whoever, unquote, it took out the Russian gas pipelines in the Baltic, did it with a small team on a small boat, relatively speaking. But if you have a rough idea where those cables are, and not to humble brag here, but I'm upgrading the electronics on my fishing boat, and the side scan and forward scan radar, not radar, sonar that you can put on a fishing boat now, I can look at the leaves on a tree in the bottom. It's I can watch fish swim. It's amazing the technology you can get just commercial off the shelf. If you can localize them, you don't need a fancy diver. All you need is a long enough line and a grappling hook and a sea anchor to control your drift, and you just drift and snag and pull. Now, people can be watching you do that, which, you know, hello to our friends in the broad area maritime surveillance, BAMS community. What is it? VUP-19, the Navy version of the Global Hawk that can stay and watch people for days on end. That's a great mission for that. You know, you can watch people who are engaged in that, and then you can have some visitors come say hello to them. But in that part of the world also, you have all these small ships by the hundreds that all look the same. Some of them smuggle, some of them fish, some of them are just merchants going from point A to point B. All you got to do is use one of those and a few people who know what they're doing. It'd be hard to find that needle in the haystack that are digging up those cables. So you pull those cables up. Is it going to affect the military situation? No. But if you get the right cable or group of cables, the economic impact is huge. You're talking financial data coming from Asia to Europe, especially. You're looking at data. You're looking at voice communications. And if you take those out, there is a fair bit of flex and redundancy in the system. They have to go find secondary ways to get their ones and zeros from point A to point B, which is other cables or via satellite. But that's all supply and demand situation. So when you have more of a demand for a finite number of products, you're going to have the owners of those products ask a higher price. So that's going to inject inflation. And especially in the financial arena, a lot of these profits and the ability for these people to just have functioning businesses is based on incredibly narrow margins that are so carefully scoped about their infrastructure. You start tearing up that infrastructure, it's no different and a little less hostile looking than if you had some guy with a truck full of explosives pull up to a power plant outside of Manchester and knocking out a power plant. You can do it a lot more low key by just ripping up some cables. So are they going to go after cables more? Do they have that capability? If I was them, I would. If my higher direction and guidance is make the West feel our pain, so to speak, that's what I would look at, because it's not too expensive to find and train people to try to get a grappling hook drug over some cables. Then all you need to have is a large enough winch to pull it up shallow enough that you can cut it.
Yeah, some of these cables are buried, you know, and they're so a little harder to get to. The concern I always saw for these undersea cable things was the connector points where they come ashore. And, you know, those would be pretty vulnerable to some kind of attack. I think that was a concern pretty right after 9/11. And it is a, you know, it's one of those things that you have to worry about. But, you know, I don't know. I can't remember. I think I read somewhere that cable comes ashore somewhere in Yemen or maybe Saudi Arabia. And, it, you know, I think that's a vulnerability where that would be probably easier to go after than we would like to think. The undersea cables are fairly large, but as you know, they're not the only things down there. You can have a heavy anchor dragging along them could probably, you know, especially if the depending upon what the bottom looks like, could probably dig its way down and yank those things. So I don't know if we know exactly what caused that outage, but it is one of those great concerns, as you said. I mean, for economic, if you want to screw up the economics for a while, well, let's interrupt the flow of traffic through the Red Sea, and we're going to impact Saudi's ability to get oil to Europe. We're going to impact Europe getting, you know, the stuff, the Amazon packages through the Suez Canal. We're going to hurt the Egyptians. We don't, you know, all because of whatever. So it is an issue. Yeah. So, well, we got that. We got what else? We got other things there. The new players. We got the other new players. The Italians have been out there. They shot down some Houthi things with their 76 millimeter gun. I think
it's nice to see Yalta Molera getting her workout, because you talk about a gun that has been involved and improved of in an iterative manner. If people really want to geek out, I would go look at what the modern, not just the radar interface and weapons control for the old 76 millimeter Auto Malera, but some of their, they had just a whole slew of different warheads. The Italian Navy, I think the Italians spend 1.4% of their GDP, maybe 1.5 on defense. They're one of those people I would love that if and when they reach 2%, if they could just invest that in their Navy, because they just build some really capable warships, and they could just, hey, you know, it's been a few thousand years. Why don't you just take bed for it? Just be nice to the Greeks.
I mean, yeah, the 76 millimeter gun, for those who want to compute it to compare it to some of the U.S., they're about the same as the old U.S. Navy three inch guns, except they're much more automatic and many times more capable than the ones that I remember being on the U.S. Navy ships, especially on the auxiliaries a long, long time ago.
Yeah, I mean, even when I was a midshipman, some of our auxiliaries, I believe some of our amphibs as well, still had those dual 3 inches that you would see on World War II ships. They were still out there.
Yeah, it was interesting. there were some decisions made during the Vietnam War about warnings about potential aircraft attacks against some of those amphibs and auxiliary ships, and a lot of the people said, "Well, what are we going to do about it? We got a 3-inch 50. It's not going to do a lot of good." So I don't think anybody lost any sleep thinking that was going to, you know, if it happens, it happens kind of thing. Not we're going to man that thing 24/7 and blow these things out of the sky.
Yeah, it's a very, it's one of those things, well, we can try, but many years ago I read an account of during the unpleasantness between Israel and her neighbors back in 1973 when we almost came to blows against the Soviets in the Mediterranean, that a couple of staff officers asked a real, they asked a question or made a couple of observations. There were two things. It's like, we really don't have any anti-ship weapons out here to speak of. The Soviets have a whole bunch of them. And I'm not sure that we have the ability to shoot down any of the missiles that might shoot our ships. What do we do? Because they, you know, a lot of the systems that they had were still, you know, based on what they might have faced 25 years earlier. They just didn't keep up with the times. But that gave a nice impetus to advance our missile development a little bit better. Because we had a few missile firing ships, but most of them were one-armed bandits that can, for those that remember the, what was it, the California class, they called it a cruiser, had two one-armed bandits on it.
Yeah.
The Mark 13 launcher that the Oliver Hazard Perry frigates used to have. You just, you know, you would hope that they would just send you one at a time in a polite manner. The things a modern Aegis ship could do was what people in their mind said we needed back in 1973. It took a while for us to get there, but we eventually got there.
Yeah, well, you know, pretty soon we're going to have these laser beams and we'll be able to attach them to sharks. No, that's a different thing. but we're going to be able to zap things out of the sky with those. You know, it's going to happen. We don't know when. But it take, you know, things take time. I mean, look at the USS Boise. It's finally going to the yard after, what, 9 years? And it'll eventually come out, too, I think, in another 5 years or something. What?
I know they don't do submarine work, and it, you know, we've talked about the, quote, problem appreciation, unquote, problem about shipyards, but the if our comparative advantage in a lot of scenarios in Oakland our submarine force, it's amazing how undercapitalized it's been, and this has been known for a long time. The Boise is one example. And I know they don't do nuclear submarines, so it's not going to help that. But I also, we didn't talk about this in the pre-show, but I'm sure it came into your scan. The talking to Hyundai Heavy Industries with the SECNAV about maybe what they could be interested in doing for shipyards here in the U.S., that just really kind of said, hey, as long as it's additive, not substitutive, if we've got to call the Koreans in to, at least on the surface side of the house, help us with our shipyards, then you know, that's what we got to do. But the Koreans really look interested in getting in the game.
Well, I wouldn't blame them. I mean, we've got the Australians involved in with the Austral yards, you know, nominally U.S. We've got the who owns the yard that our good friend up in Wisconsin has got that's Finnick. Yeah, it's Italians. I mean, why not get the Koreans? You know, they're building great ships. If you go to the Hyundai Heavy Industry site and go to their warship section, there's some impressive ships they've got going there. So
they do. And yeah. You know this generation better than I do because you're closer to them. But
old.
No. Experienced and wise. When I read that, and I put this in a DM to somebody, first thing that came to mind is that I thought of my father's generation, who were of draft age. My dad did not fight in Korea. He was in college. I'll tell everybody his story of the power of a Navy flight surgeon versus the U.S. Air Force. Anyway, but I grew up with his friends who did. And a lot of them who served in Korea also served in Vietnam. And so when I was growing up, they usually would talk what they did talk about Vietnam and occasionally about Korea. But and you can, Anybody that has access to old National Geographics, you know, look at Korea in the 1950s. South Korea was in, you know, pre-war Korea, before it was divided, you know, the North was the rich part of Korea and the South was the poor, rural, backwards part of Korea. It was poor, rural, ravaged by war, no infrastructure, just, you know, talk about somebody, something broken, a nation broken down to parade rest. That was her. Over, I believe, about 30,000 Americans died during the Korean conflict. A lot more wounded, of course. And we're still having, you know, plenty of forces over there. If you look at what they fought for, if you told them when the armistice was signed in 53, I believe, what that, you know, here they'd be in 2023, that we would be looking for the South Koreans to bring us modern and effective shipyards, they might be a little surprised, a little shocked, but they've got to be a little bit proud too, is there's a great test case, North Korea versus South Korea. And they should be really proud that war that they fought, for the South Koreans especially, it worked. It worked.
Yeah, it's a great story. My dad did fight in that war. He was flying Air Force A-26s, I think. They were the attack version with the machine guns and the nose. You know, B-26, yeah. A-26, whatever they were. He was flying those. He has lots of pictures that I've got the slides of around here. And Korea was torn up. I went there a few times for various Navy things that I got to do. And, you know, they're a very proud country, and they deserve to be proud. I mean, if you've ever been to Seoul, Korea, it is amazing that it was once a completely destroyed city. You know, they've got all these great industries, their technology is first rate. It is not a third world country. It's not a second world country. It is a first world country in many, many, many respects. And they deserve the pride. And if Hyundai, which they're building ships, merchant ships, they have great stuff. And they're always, you know, they're living on the edge too, because they never know what that lunatic or the lunatic society north of them is going to do. So they take it all very seriously, and their troops are some of the finest in the world, or they were at least. I know during Vietnam, and I think we had some participate in Desert Storm and some of the other things. So good people, and very strongly committed to the freedoms that they have as compared to, especially as compared to their northern brethren.
And I think also Korean Americans are just like Vietnamese Americans. You know, one war a draw, one a win, one a loss, I mean. But they've also been just tremendous immigrants and the families they've raised here. I know, you know, we've both grown up and served with them. It's good. I mean, one of the tragic things about South Korea, though, is if you look at their demographics, they're a nation that's going to disappear by the end of the century if they don't decide some generation soon doesn't decide to have any kids. They have some of the lowest birth rates in the world. So they built this huge economy and vibrant society just in time for them as a people to pretty much disappear. Their demographics are worse than mainland China, which is real common in East Asia. But they're very resilient societies. They've survived worse. They'll figure it out. They're smart people.
They'll sort it out. The Japanese are facing the same issue. The Chinese got the same issue. I don't, you know, there are other populous countries that don't seem to be having that problem. But speaking of that Far East, the Philippines seem to be up gunning. They're looking at buying more.
Yep.
And from Hyundai Heavy Industries, as a matter of fact, some warships. They've been doing joint ops with the U.S. both air and sea, which is, of course, irritating the heck out of the Chinese, which I'd like to. I love being a burr under their saddle. So
extra bonus.
extra bonus, yeah. So that's good. But got to worry about the Norks now. Norks now have the North Koreans now have a new anti-ship cruise missile that they're playing with. So one more irritating facts about the North Koreans. They can do some things.
Yeah, there are when you basically have slave state, which is what they have, you can do a lot as long as you keep the mass of your people very much suppressed. They're not even a communist nation anymore. There's some dystopian feudal reboot. God, what a mess that's going to be. I've read a couple things where the South Koreans are like, we don't want unification. We don't want to have to try to fix that. We saw what happened to the Germans. We're not up for it. They may not get a choice, but history will figure that out one way or another.
Yeah. Yep.
Speaking of history, are we allowed, if we use the word schadenfreude, can we have fun at the misery of our German brethren? Because really, what are they? Anybody who's served on a senior staff knows exactly how this happened. But what I'm talking about is something that I feel sorry for the players. I'm not happy that the Russians got an easy win. But I'm laughing because I know exactly how stuff like this could happen. I'm talking about how it came out. And when it first came out, I agreed that, you know, there's a non-zero chance that this could just be Russia being Russia and making crap up like they do. But it came out today. Chancellor Scholz said, yeah, no, actually, this really happened. The inspector of the Luftwaffe, which is their equivalent of the U.S. Air Force Chief of Staff, i.e. their senior general for their Air Force, he was on a WebEx, which is kind of a old, busted, and scratchety version of, for those that have used it, know what I'm talking about, compared to like Zoom or even Microsoft Teams. WebEx is a much more clunkier version of that. They did a non-secure meeting with him. It was another general officer, I think it was a two-star, three lieutenant colonels, a major, and a captain, and they talked about everything from the readiness of their Air Force to whether their Taurus is going to be delivered, how it's going to be delivered. They talked about the presence of NATO nationals in Ukraine. And the Russians found a way, and this is a warning to everybody, it makes you wonder, wow, I wonder what else they have. The Russians found a way to tap into it. And they got a recording, and the Russians joyfully played it on one of their programs. And it's just a reminder to everybody, but especially if you're the Russian penetration of the German military and the German government is well documented. It's just worm-ridden with Russian access. But that's true with everybody. If you are on a senior staff doing interesting things and you're overseas and you really, really, really have to have a meeting, but you can't find a secure means, just having a meeting anyway and saying, well, what are the odds that they're going to tap into our WebEx? Probably is not a real smart idea. And everybody who's had classified discussions on via non-secure means, probably there's probably a recording of you somewhere in Beijing or Moscow or both that's just waiting for an opportune time for them to bring it out. It's a funny story, but it also is an eye-opener, I think, about, you know, technology and how addicted that we've come to being able to have conversations.
Yeah, I think along those lines, the President of the United States has appeared on TikTok now. And after all of us know that TikTok is a Chinese information gathering system, I am stunned that, and obviously probably not discussing classified information, but, you know, opening that door is, I think, extremely problematic. And I cannot believe he did that.
Yeah, I agree in the fact that this has been in the news for a long time. Yep. I'm going to pop off in a second to go check.
I'm still here. Anybody have any questions they'd like to ask?
I'll just put in my two cents here before I run off for a second.
I don't even know if the ship is manned right now or if they just have a skeleton crew or what.
Yeah, I think the TikTok thing as well is, and Representative Gallagher has pretty much put all the cards on the table there. We know it's a Chinese Communist Party-controlled organ, and I don't care if it was President Biden or former President.
All right, what happened is that Sal's gone off into another room to talk to a caller to see if he wants him to say anything. So that's where it is. The other things we need to talk about, I think, as we go along are the Chinese crane. We're talking Chinese infiltrating various things, the Chinese cranes that we're now going to spend bunches of billions of dollars to make sure that we can replace them with U.S. cranes and stuff, because those things are also technologically apparently capable of doing all kinds of harm to the Western way of life. And let's see. Oh, yeah, there's a new guide that just came out on the Navy. It's one of the congressional research service things on the Navy force structure and shipbuilding plans. That just came out March 1st. You can get it by going to the Congressional Research Service website and looking for their latest releases.
I'm back.
So I'll give you that. I'll give you that website here in a second.
Eagle One, can you hear me?
Okay.
Can anybody else hear me in the chat room? I seem to have lost. Make sure everything's connected. Is everything connected?
No, Sal, I cannot hear you. Can you hear me?
Break 1, 2, 3. Can you hear me now? Okay, they can hear me, but you can't evidently. Huh. Hello?
Live radio is fun.
Okay, well, I'll go ahead and monologue.
Paul, I'm glad you can hear both of us, because I can't hear Sal. So I'm going to do my own reboot here and see if I can get him back on.
Okay, well, as he's recycling circuit breakers, I think we picked on the Germans enough today, and I know we kind of jumped on each other with TikTok. The caller that came in, he wanted to ask a question that really wasn't germane to the subjects we on Midrat. So the thing about TikTok, in case y'all missed it when we were talking past each other, is the reason we're not acting on it is pure politics. We know what TikTok is. We know what it's being used for. And we know, especially when it comes to shaping perceptions by those that use it, that are mostly young, that it's destructive. But the reason why nothing's being done about it is because it has become so popular. It's the same thing as if somebody in your family is addicted to a drug, and if you try to take them to detox, or if they're an alcoholic or whatever, they're going to get mad at you. It's the same thing, but it's not good for them. It's not good for the family. TikTok's not good for the country. And it's beneficial, though, if you want to access a lot of people. And I do not think that history is going to smile on the remaining inaction on our part to do something about TikTok. And our politicians, whoever they are, who are willingly using this for domestic political gain. I think it's not illegal and it's not unethical, but at least in my structure, it is immoral. There's not much that we can do about that, but it's sad to see. Eagle One, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you. I have my mute, normal mute button. Just I had to reboot Skype for some reason. So
that's Okay. We'll blame the caller. How about that?
There you go.
I just gave my monologue on because when I came back from talking to our caller there, you and I talked over each other on TikTok. So I did my little monologue on the absence part of it. One thing, you know, we were talking about history and stuff like that. Another thing I noticed for those that are tracking there, what's going on in the Red Sea, is the Russians a few days ago had one of their Udaloy Pacific Fleet, Udaloy 1s, come out of Qatar. It's now in the Arabian Sea. From what I've read in a couple sources, it's there for counter-piracy reasons. I don't know whether it's getting involved in the Red Sea or not. An interesting note about it, though, is it's not your dad's Udaloy. The youngest Udaloy, the last Udaloy 2, I believe, is 33 years old or so. But this is the Marshal I can't pronounce Russian very well, Shapochnikov, which I apology to my Russian speakers. But it's a 39-year-old ship that 3 or 4 years ago it had a fire, so it was converted into a frigate. So normal Udaloy, you know, it has those 2 4 packs on either side of those SSN-14 anti-submarine warfare rockets. Those are gone. They've been replaced with they also pulled off one of the 200-millimeter guns that the Udaloy 1s had. The Udaloy 2 had the 130-millimeter extra pepper guns, so it just has 100-millimeter now. They've replaced it instead with BLS cells for caliber cruise missiles, and it also carries some other anti-ship cruise missiles, call it frigate. They've been given some other modernizations, but it's 39 years old. And, you know, we looked at the Rapushka that the Ukrainians sunk recently. The one that sunk 33 years old. Slava cruiser, a whole one, now called Moskva, she was over 40 years old. It's like this is the swan song of the big Russian Navy, because when you look at the building right now, as we've talked before on the show, it is a small Corvette frigate-based, at best, coastal to regional Navy. But they will roll out their old ships as long as they do. It is nice to see the Udaloy getting underway, because the Soviet designers, they had a good eye for drawing attractive ships. She is a beautiful ship.
Yeah, I think you can make a mistake, though, if you assume the Russians are – I mean, yeah, they recognize that they're never going to be able to compete on the high seas with the U.S. and European navies, but except in the submarine force. They're still building subs, and some of the subs and some of the weapons they're putting on those subs are pretty impressive. So, you know, it's not really a time to relax about them, but it is time to really start working on ASW stuff again.
Yeah, their ASW is, it's no joke. And like ASW is kind of like electronic warfare. There's so much we don't rightfully know out in open source, not just about capabilities of the subsurface unit, but the ability to try to loke track and attack it. But the Soviets are not slowing down on their modernization of their units. They don't have as many. But there's nobody else out there besides our friends that build a quality boat like they do.
Yeah, and it's you know, you're talking about their electronic warfare. You know, they like the Chinese have been watching what we do. They, you know, they're designing systems to interfere with our systems, to which makes perfect sense. We'll do the same thing. So you develop a system, they develop a counter. You develop the counter to the counter, or you move the next level. I mean, it's kind of like when the days when the people were intercepting radio signals and the Hollywood star started dealing with the ability to ship, you know, frequency change. kind of automatic frequency change. Well, that, you know, that's kind of where we are with this, the stage of some of the technology. So if you're gonna interfere with GPS, that's going to have an effect. And so now they've got to have a counter to their interference with GPS. And you know how that goes. We're all over the map on this stuff. But it's an interesting question.
And I think the experience in Ukraine, now going on its third year, I think highlights your point perfectly. And it even, you know, ties in the technology. For instance, you mentioned lasers earlier. The key to lasers is power. And the Ponce, you know, when she experimented with her laser last decade, what we have now, it's even greater. And the more kilowatts you can have, which warships especially can generate, as that technology continues to grow, we look at our layered defenses. We talked last week with Brian McGrath that, you know, we're using our 5-inch guns, our ESSMs, our phalanxes, our standard missiles 2, 3, and 6. There's no one tool that's going to answer all your problems. But when we get the point that we have a large enough kilowatt laser on board our ships as another tool, that is going to be a renaissance in ways that until you get a counter to it, because it's always a game of counter, as we've seen in Ukraine. For instance, one of the big game changers, to use that word kind of pejoratively in this regard, everybody said these very accurate weapons where you can just, you fire one as opposed to 100. And it did work, like the Excaliburs for the GPS-guided rockets coming from HIMARS. Had a huge impact, huge initial impact. Well, for every action, there's going to be a reaction. And we haven't heard as much about them recently, probably because there's a limited supply, but also probably, and again, have no knowledge of this, and frankly, I don't want to because I don't have the clearance anymore. Odds are the Russians, which have a very good electronic warfare tradition, they have found ways to counter those, to blunt those. You can look at some of the, then you had the UAVs and the small little UAVs that they've used to substitute for their lack of air power to go after armor and to go after bunkers and things like that. You look at some of the recent, a lot of them were made in somebody's backyard, but if they work, they work. Jammers that the Russians are now putting on their vehicles. From what I've been able to hear, those are having an effect. So you've got to find a workaround to that. So you have this Darwinian battlefield that's being accelerated. So a lot of these changes would have already taken place, but their need would either not have been realized or funded until 2028, 2030, 2032, but you're now seeing it at that improvement cycle, that action reaction taking place in, you know, 4 to 6 month intervals. Really fascinating to see where, you know, we've had to go back to cluster munitions, that you use the best traditional artillery methods that you can, but you got that DIPM. How do you pronounce that? I'm not an Army guy. The little cluster warhead on the 155 millimeter. You launch that puppy, and that hopefully will get the job done with all the problems that come with it. So it plays into that battle of the technology is great, but two things can be true at one time. You have an iterative battlefield where you have measure, countermeasure, but also mass matters. How many artillery tubes you have, how many armored vehicles you have, how much infantry that you have to hold body. It really is, it's reinforcing a lot of the traditional universals, but also you see some of these interesting technologies developing that in a few other iterations. At sea, like you mentioned, the lasers is going to be incredible. The semi-autonomous, when you go from these first-person view UAVs to semi-autonomous, when you have the sensor heads and the coding refined enough that they can be fire and forget, as opposed to I have to fly it right into the target. That's going to be interesting to watch evolve, and it will evolve, I believe, in a very accelerated manner if this war continues to go on, because they're running out of people. So if you run out of people, if you want to keep fighting, you've got to try to lean on technology.
Yeah, I think we're just getting into a lot of this stuff that's going to be important. But, you know, again, I think one of the arguments against lasers used to be, well, they're just going to cover their vessel or their aircraft with mirrors, and the stuff's going to bounce right off. I don't know. I just, I know that, like, we're doing stuff now with the XQ-58 Valkyrie that the Marine Corps is playing with. You know, they're looking at using this as a sensor. We'll have extra sensors on this thing. That means your aircraft can go, the manned aircraft can go quiet and use the sensor reads from the unmanned aircraft. And they're also going to use them, again, we've got all these ideas of, we're going to have missile trucks. Well, these things can also be, weapons platforms under the control of F-35 or something. So, these things are exciting. They're great. But you always have to keep in mind that if the minute you say you've got this, somebody somewhere else is going, let's see now if I can make a jamming mechanism. And we do this too. I mean, we when we look at UAVs and stuff, we have already fielded the Marines and the Army, all kinds of devices to stop those things from overflying our compounds and stuff. The one exception was where you got these guys killed in Syria or Jordan, wherever exactly they were, was that it, as I think you said it, the bad guy drone followed in the good guy drone, and that is a problem. You've got to be able to sort out who's doing what when.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I believe early on in the show in the chat room, Paul, had mentioned, it was Paul or Lee, one of the two, had mentioned
Paul.
About all these attacks that we have seen on our bases in Iraq and Syria. Yes, American public, we still have bases in Iraq and Syria, a lot of which are full of reservists and National Guardsmen, but that's a pet peeve I can talk about some other day. We've been successful in the fact that we've had a lot of injuries. We have lost 3 soldiers, but considering the amount of incoming fire we've taken, and we don't know why we've been as successful, and frankly, we shouldn't know why. In an unclassified open source level, because you don't want to tell your enemy why you're being able to succeed. But if people are looking for confidence and good news, one thing the U.S. is good about is, though we may not advertise it, it might be hard to find, we don't suppress information on our casualties. We know who's being killed and who's being injured. And those numbers from the Red Sea, Iraq, and Syria, and in the Mediterranean, where we've had a couple of interesting things too, it's been pretty impressive. So we're doing some things right, and I know from a couple of people, I'm sure you've heard it as well. We are trying to soak up as many lessons as we can from both events, because it's when everybody focuses back on what is the big game, which is in the Western. I don't know how good the PRC is of soaking in the lessons that they can soak in as well. But usually in free societies, we have a faster decision loop if it's properly led and funded to be able to respond to things. So hopefully we're going to be a little bit ahead of them in that regard, going again to that technology versus mass. There are potential adversary in the Western Pacific has 1 billion people more than we do. They've got the mass. They've got a larger Navy than we do. So our smart guys thinking about ways to better use what we have and to take those lessons we're learning and finding a way in a relatively quick manner to get that in the hands of soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. That's what's going to make the difference for us.
Here's the risk, though. Let me interrupt you there, because February 21st is a report that a Japan-based chief petty officer is charged with espionage. He's a fire fire control chief assigned to the USS Higgins, DDG-76, and he's going to for a court-martial. He's apparently selling secret information to a foreign power, to a foreign citizen. So, you know, you got to remember that, you know, everybody, all nations have spies. Some people are going to, for whatever reason, decide that they need to give this information to somebody, and you never know what why they decided that, whether it was for love or money, because we were always warned about honeypots and all that good stuff. But you know, it's just so irksome to have the technology we have, and then have some guy, and of course he's just accused right now, but some guy who apparently. Allegedly, has transferred information that was classified to this foreign national. And, you know, why? Love or money? But that is just not a good thing.
I was trying to be optimistic for a change. Just, there you go. Bring me back to reality. But here's the thing. It makes you want to, yeah.
I have something optimistic for you. Okay. Yeah. Wait a minute. We're going to go to a load. This is Appendix D to the Navy shipbuilding, latest Navy shipbuilding thing from the Congressional Research Service. All right. Summary of some acquisition lesson learned for Navy shipbuilding. At the outset, get the operational requirements for the program right. Properly identify the program's operational requirements at the outset. Manage risk by not trying to do too much in terms of the program's operational requirements. You know. Well, duh. Got it. Let them use mature technologies. Use land-based prototyping and testing to bring new technologies to a high state of maturity before incorporating them into ship designs. And limit the number of major new technologies to be incorporated into a new ship design. Impose cost discipline up front. Use realistic price estimates. employ competition where possible. Use contract type that is appropriate to the amount of risk involved. Minimize design construction concurrency by developing design to a high level of completion before starting construction and resisting changes in requirements. Properly supervise construction work. Provide stability for industry, in part by using wherever possible multi-year procurement programs. Maintain a capable government acquisition workforce that understands what it is buying, as well as the above points. I mean, good Lord, that was stuff they've taken from your blog, my blog, and our program, and put in here. I mean, that is.
Did we get
I'm
a
so glad to see,
somewhere? Did we get? Did
I
we get one footnote?
No, no, but I'm so.
What you're trying to tell me?
So glad to see that, Brent.
They've decided to take the boldface items of building a Navy from roughly 1500 to 2500 years, and have decided after two decades and change that, you know what, maybe 500 years of experience actually was onto something. Now, I agree, better late than never, but good God almighty, it's just a shame that here we are right now only having to hear that stuff.
Well, look, I'm pleased that, you know, there somebody said, hey, dummies, guess what? This is how you do things and do it right.
Well, and I'll just add, though, it goes to the fact that I'll put a plug here. I just realized that we've run over. Amazing. But that's okay. I love our technical Navy. I love our engineers and everything, but how we ill train, ill teach, and ill nurture our history, it's detrimental. Like one thing I've done the last two Fridays, I'm going to do two more. I reached into my archives on my full bore Friday because Vice Admiral Cooper, who I like Vice Admiral Cooper. He's a great professional. I think we're all blessed to have him. Amen and et cetera. But he's done us a service when he made that comment about what's happening in the Red Sea. The first combat of our Navy since World War II, I about popped a circuit breaker. And what I've done is given a little top of my hat to young junior officer, one, Butterbar one, i.e. your generation of junior officers, and the between 68 and 72, the U.S. Navy off of Vietnam did some incredible combat operations, receiving 300 rounds of 122 and 152 millimeter shore batteries, cruise missiles, fighter aircraft dropping bombs on your deck, fast patrol boats coming in. And a lot of people don't remember that because people want to forget about Vietnam, especially anything that happened at sea for some reason. Are people just, well, yeah, the Navy was like an apocalypse now. It's like, no, nah, a little more than that. No, it wasn't all aircraft carriers. So I brought that back as the fact that, no, we have a very good history, and a lot of people have demonstrated a lot of things that are still applicable for today, whether it's proper program management or things that you need to be able to fight an opponent who shoots back into the littoral. And I know that we've taken a pot shot here and there in the Arabian Gulf over the year, whether it's an Exocet or a mine. But no, in living memory, the guys at the exchange, they might have been one of the guys on one of those destroyers or cruisers who came up within mooning range of the North Korean coast and went gun to gun with their shore batteries. We have a tremendous history in our Navy that amazing that so many people just, it's not even in the back of their mind.
Well, yeah. and yet the history involves hitting mines, which we seem to always put in the back of the area. I mean, they've got hit mines off, during Desert Storm, we hit mines off Korea, we hit mines, we had our own mines, apparently, off Vietnam when the Warrington ran into a mine. The Higby got bombed, and fortunately the crew had gone to lunch from the after gun mount, and the thing dropped into that mount, so nobody was killed, but it did do some damage to that mount. I can't believe memories are that short. And given the fact that we were flying so many aircraft sorties off the carriers and had three and sometimes more carriers there doing things, I mean, those were combat operations. We lost a lot of people. I don't know where Admiral Cooper got his history, but if he's talking about surface stuff, I mean, we were using at some point, we were even using the Dash helicopter. Drone anti-submarine helicopters, the Dash units, to spot gunfire for some of the ships. So, you know, nothing is new, and it's a little disappointing to hear that the people who served Vietnam or in-country Vietnam were not really in combat, I guess. So.
Yeah, that was really surprising. I don't know about you, but if I was having 300 rounds popping off around me, yeah, I might take it a little personal if somebody tells me it didn't happen, but it won't be the first time that folks have forgotten.
Oh, we when I was over there, we had ships come alongside who had, you know, they'd had a round go through their, not the superstructure, but at least through their masts and stuff, you know, and do some damage. And, yeah, I mean, it wasn't, and also the ships that went charging into Hanoi or Haiphong Harbor. I mean, there was a great story there about how the cruiser, I think maybe it's the Oklahoma City, and destroyers went charging in there to do some damage. I know there's a book on it, man. I'll have to dig that out because that's a good reference to talk about how they went head to head with the, and it wasn't that the North Vietnamese had a big Navy, but they did have torpedo boats and stuff like that. So
yeah, and they had lots of coastal batteries and stuff like that. Yeah, like this is one of the occasions. If anybody wants to hear a skipper up with the 1MC, years ago, I found the audio of the Captain Lindsey McCanny of the Newport News, CA-148, when they and the McCormick went in against shore batteries on the 17th of December of 1967. And his after-action wash-up, somebody recorded on the 1MC, and so I turned it into a YouTube video. But if anybody goes over to my Substack on Friday, they can listen to that there. It's funny. It's most 1MC calls are kind of womp 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 womp, And it sounds like that, except it's a hell of a combat experience. So I always wonder, you know, how many skippers out there could get up and give a recap like he did. It was really impressive.
Yeah.
Operation Sea Dragon. Well, hey, on that note, I guess we should call it a day. Dinners are cooking downstairs. We do have guests for the next 2 weeks, but I only got through half of my questions, so I guess we'll have to do a free-for-all again at some point.
All right, anytime. It gives us a chance to demonstrate our full ignorance.
Well, we appreciate everybody joining us for another edition of Midrats. And until next time, we hope everybody has a great Navy day. Cheers.
Marry me and so leave the strand and Piccadilly.